We're talking about whether the media has blown it on climate change, and hopefully we'll have some interesting perspectives on that today. I'm Dan Grossman. I did my first reports on climate change in the 1990s when I was on the staff of the show, the radio program Living on Earth. And that's where actually I heard about and interviewed Joe Rome, who was an assistant secretary of energy for energy efficiency at the time. And since then, I've gone on to make climate change my beat for about the last 13 years. I believe it's the most important topic of our times. And so it's with perplexity and consternation that I've noticed that climate change gets relatively scant coverage in the U.S. media. That's changing somewhat. But even today, we mostly hear about climate change when there's a blockbuster report like the IPCC report or a big meeting like the climate convention in Copenhagen, and or maybe some new scientific finding that was published in Nature or Science. Most of the time, I think many of you will probably agree, and I think the people on this panel will probably agree, it's superficial and not that good. The media is society's early warning system, and it's the way that most adults get new information about the world. And on this topic, climate change, it's been pretty much of a failure. Our speakers today will discuss why and perhaps give us some suggestions for how the media could do better in the future. We're going to start with Peter Dykstra. He's reported on science and the environment for more than two decades. He worked at CNN for 17 years, where he was among the last journalists to be let go when the network dissolved its environment unit. He's gone on to work for the Pew Charitable Trusts. He produced a video series for the National Science Foundation. He's the publisher of Environmental Health News and The Daily Climate. Next, we're going to hear from Joe Rome, who was a senior fellow at the American Progress Action Fund. There he edits the Climate Progress blog, which he founded. Climate deniers love to spar with Joe, who they disparage as a warmist and as the alarmist's alarmist. Many others see his blog as the up-to-the-moment source of information about science, technology, and policy. Thomas Friedman calls it excellent and indispensable. In 2009, Time magazine named Joe a hero of the environment. He's the son of a newspaper editor, and he's a PhD. He has a PhD in physics from MIT. Catherine Bagley is the newbie among us, but as a staff member of Inside Climate News, she's in a good position to talk about the state of climate reporting today. She studied earth and environmental sciences as an undergraduate and journalism as a graduate student at Columbia University. And looking over her many freelance stories, I was most intrigued by her article, 10 Sneaky Spots Germs Are Hiding. There I discovered that desktops have more bacteria than toilet seats. And that's pretty scary, but as I see it, the good news is that I don't have to worry about toilet seats anymore. So let's begin.
Thanks, Dan. I want to set the stage for a minute. And first of all, is the audio okay, or should I pull the mic forward? All right. You all know what's going on in Washington. And as journalists, you and we are all charged with the responsibility of communicating to a public that sometimes doesn't want to be communicated to about these things. A couple of quick metaphors and takeaways. We're looking right now in Washington at a large segment of the federal government that despises wasteful government spending, but has voted for the same piece of fruitless legislation 40 times. Looking at a lot of people who adore the bald eagle as the national symbol, but want to bring back DDT, and a lot of people who charge that climate scientists are in it for the money, but the oil and coal companies aren't. That's not the entire public, but as we see from Washington today, is the segment of the public that has outsized influence on everything, and certainly that's been the case. And the very reason that so little has been acted on the policy front, despite the overwhelming science on climate. I want to give you a couple of stories. A couple of my old CNN colleagues in the audience, and you may remember a little bit of this. The closest I ever came in 17 years at CNN of getting cable television news executives to understand what it meant to cover science and cover climate change and filter out what's science and what's politics and what's BS and what's real. It was around 1999, the top executives at CNN actually all gathered in the same room to have a climate change discussion. I think that's the only time it's ever happened. It's probably the only time that probably hasn't happened since. But I decided that I would speak to them in language that cable television news executives understand. And so I said, climate change is like the O.J. Simpson trial, which in 1999 cable television executives understood. There are two different standards in the American justice system, and a lot of people who don't follow this stuff every day like you do, on any question, any debate, will default to the criminal standard. Guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. Those of you who follow climate know that there is a cottage industry out there, maybe bigger than a cottage industry, charged with manufacturing that reasonable doubt. And a lot of people at the top levels in news organizations, including the one I work for, don't understand that science doesn't work that way. Science is a lot closer to the civil standard of deciding issues, preponderance of evidence. And I laid it out for these cable TV news executives who are, there's no other word than to say they're clueless on things like this. In the criminal standard, even though the entire country pretty much knew O.J. Simpson was guilty, he was found not guilty because of reasonable doubt. You know, the bloody glove and the racist cop and everything else were enough reason to let him go and seek the real killer. And most of this audience is old enough to remember the O.J. Simpson trial. When I speak to college classes now, I can't use the O.J. Simpson metaphor because they were 2 years old when it happened, but I can use the Casey Anthony case from a few years ago. But then think about the civil standard. The whole country still knows that O.J. did it, and under the standard of preponderance of evidence, action was taken, he was found guilty, and he owed the Brown and the Golden families $20 million. That's the difference. Light bulbs went off. These are cable television news executives, so the light bulbs were not necessarily high wattage, but they went off. I'll give you another example just to put things in perspective that to me really illustrated. And I've been out of CNN for 5 years, but I'm pretty sure these things still apply in the decision-making process there, even though the science has further established that we ought to be taking this problem seriously and that people like Mark Moreno should not be appearing on the Piers Morgan show as a credentialed and credible spokesman for a side that has no leg to stand on. Climate change was not the toughest issue I had to sell to these executives. The toughest issue I had to sell to them was any story about evolution and creationism. But the reason that that was so tough explains a lot about why they were reluctant on climate change. They were terrified that any story that called creationism into question would drive people away from CNN and drive them to Fox News. You cannot underestimate, not just in cable TV news, but everywhere, the impact that Fox News has had in pushing the debate to the political right and pushing it toward the anti-science side as far as issues like this are concerned. We had a perfect story. It was a TV grand slam. The National Park Service during the Bush administration was essentially compelled to sell books in the Grand Canyon National Park bookstore, closed today, I might add, that explained that the Grand Canyon was only 7,000 years old and it was created by the Great Flood and it had all this pseudoscience behind it. You know, what a great story, what a great debate, what a passionate story, and the TV bonus, of course, is that your pictures are all going to be from the Grand Canyon. What can possibly go wrong with the story? They wouldn't touch it. because you would, to tell a story, you would have had to criticize creationism, and that would have sent people to Fox News. That's my specific experience. It somewhat applies to other media, but it's out there and it's everywhere. I'll tell you one final thing about CNN. The boss of CNN at the same time, lovely man, as my former CNN colleagues will attest, came up to me after this meeting with the O.J. Simpson stuff, and he slapped me on the back. He's like 6'8" and 500 pounds. He's twice my size. And he slapped me on the back. He said, you know what my problem is? If I have a question about foreign policy, and remember this in terms of what big-time editors and publishers think like, if I have a problem with foreign policy and I need to understand something, I can just get Henry Kissinger or Madeleine Albright on the phone. But if I have a question about this global warming stuff, all I have is you. And, you know, for every me that's out there or used to be out there in a news organization, it's horrifying enough that this guy would go on the word of Henry Kissinger and Madeleine Albright to tell the world about foreign policy. But he would be a lot less confident in you know, the one guy out there who the science geek, the kid who gets beat up in the journalism gym class every day, to explain things to him in a way that he's comfortable to put on the air. And those are the kind of roadblocks I had. And again, this is almost 5 years ago, but those things still apply. I'll tell you a little bit about my current job and situation. I hope you guys look at the Daily Climate and Inside Climate News and Joe's invaluable stuff every day. Every year, Douglas Fisher, our Daily Climate editor, takes the stories we aggregate. Between Daily Climate and Environmental Health News, we aggregate about 200 stories every morning and then shoot them at you out of a fire hose. By the way, for attending the session, that's all free for you to access. Of course, it's free for everybody else, too. But and the coverage has gone down in volume since Douglas started doing this over the last 5 years. But it's beginning to bottom out, and we're seeing signs that it may start to come back up. That deals with quality. The concern with quantity is one that's a central question to this group, and that's that the institutional memory in news organizations is disappearing because often the science and environment people are the first people laid off. And that's a huge problem. I wanted to end with just a few pieces of guidance for navigating. If you're pitching climate stories as a freelancer to editors or you're pitching them as a staffer to editors, a lot of people trip up on the whole issue of the skeptics and deniers. Because the editors are a little bit cowed and a little bit spineless, and they feel very uncomfortable with these issues if they're not part of a specialized science or environment publication, as some of you are. But if it's general news, they're really kind of squinchy about this stuff. You got to understand that the skeptics are going to be there forever. They're just there. There is nothing, for the most part, that you can do about them if it involves just speaking reasonably and reporting factually. They will be there, and if you don't believe me, ask Jane Fonda about Vietnam. This woman has apologized dozens of times for a serious error in judgment in her protesting the war and the way she carried it out. She feels badly about it. She's told the world that it was a mistake. She's apologized. She has developed a physical immunity to Christian forgiveness with a big segment of this country that will never forgive her. The reason that's relevant to climate change is that pretty much describes the situation that Al Gore is in. He has become sort of the Jane Fonda of climate change. To a certain segment of society, they are branded for life. And it's unfortunate, it's unfair, but I don't see that changing, and certainly not worth the effort to try and make it change. There are people who will just not be shaken, will not believe. I had a conversation once with Senator Inhofe where he told me he was glad I was fired from CNN. I said, Senator Inhofe, you look great. You look a lot younger than your age, and I hope you live to be 100. So we can see if this climate hoax thing works out the way you think it's going to work. But the deniers are just there, and we're going to have to deal with them. They are as opposed to science as they are to journalism. We are in the middle of a miniature McCarthy era that is being play-acted out in Washington, D.C. as we sit here. It is rougher than it used to be. But one of the things you can use to combat that is that science and environmental journalism really does have an extraordinary track record of being right. Not a perfect one, but a very good one. And we need to get a little bit better at communicating science and environment history to show that we're right. I think the one award out of all the award ceremonies out there that's missing is the Pulitzer Prize for I Told You So. And stuff that Dan may have been writing a long time ago, stuff that many veteran environmental journalists were writing about climate in the 1980s. One very good example is our friend Mark Schlefstein, who's here from New Orleans, who did the most his partner on the project was John McQuaid. He did the most complete description of the damage from Katrina in a series in the New Orleans paper. The only problem is he did it in 2002, 3 years before Katrina. We need to show people that the work that has been turned in by journalists like you and our colleagues out there, whether they still have jobs or not, has a tremendous track record, and that is a reason that it should be taken seriously.
Well, thank you. Let me ask you one question before we move on. You talked about what some of the problems are. Now you have your own publication, so you don't have to deal with these editors that are cowed.
Have to deal with me.
So what do you recommend for people who don't have that as an option? They don't have their own outlet. What should you tell your editor, and how are you going to convince them?
If it's a full-time job at a news organization, try and corner them. Talk a little bit, perhaps, about the history. And if you're proud of your own history, talk about that. If they're suspicious of this non-profit journalism nonsense, show them something from the Pulitzer people over here. Okay? I could talk at long length about the value of nonprofit journalism. I hope that doesn't seem self-serving, because we're not the ones that got the Pulitzer. They did. But I'll tell you, we're up and coming. It's a market. But also with the so-called traditional or mainstream news organizations, I said, to an extent, give up on the skeptics or the deniers, but don't give up on the editors, and show them that over time things are right. People are looking at James Hansen, and some have passed judgment on James Hansen that maybe he's gone too far and he's gone around the bend because he's an activist and he's getting arrested and he's chaining himself to stuff. And whatever your opinion of James Hansen is, look back at his science. Look back at what he was saying 25 years ago, and that's the science Nobel for I Told You So. And point that out. History is a valuable tool, and it is on the side of people who are reporting honestly and accurately about the science and the politics of climate change. And another thing is, don't mix the science and politics of climate change. I see a lot of TV debate shows where they still cast climate change as a debate. And the debate is between a scientist, Bill Nye in his bow tie. You think I look like the kid getting beaten up in gym class in high school. Look at Bill Nye. And it's against Mark Morano, who speaks in bumper stickers and would melt a lie detector into a puddle and has no scientific credential. Mark Morano, by the way, Douglas wrote something in Daily Climate about how the climate scientists were swift-boated with this latest IPCC report, and how the Mark Morano camp got the message out early that the IPCC was essentially apologizing and stepping back from its climate claims, none of which is borne out in the report. But the bottom line is that in the communications forum and in the public media, they got their message out first and they put the climate scientists on the defensive. And that is the textbook definition of swift boating. And some of you may know who wrote the original swift boat news story about John Kerry in 2004. Who knows the answer to that? Christie. It was Mark Morano. That's right. So this is a tactic that's been out there for a while. Also, if you look up Mark's 990, that says his base salary is $150,000. And the climate scientists he accuses of being in it for the money usually make a lot less than that.
Okay, let's move on. Joe, do you want to play your video first, or do you want to say a few things?
At the end, I'll say. I'll do
okay.
It
Go right ahead.
Well, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. It's a great pleasure. Speak to journalists. I was raised by two professional journalists, My father was the editor of the Middletown Time-Tale Record. My mother was a columnist there for a long time. And they didn't win the Pulitzer. They did hear they came in a close second for the coverage of Woodstock. My hometown is about 40 miles from Woodstock, and they did some great reporting on that. I actually decided not to become a writer and journalist because I saw how poorly they were paid, and so I went into science, but 30 years later ended up pretty much as a journalist anyway, so I guess you really can't escape that sort of thing. It was really my brother losing his home in Hurricane Katrina that got me talking to climate scientists, because my brother wanted advice as to whether he should rebuild or not. And that's when I realized that the situation was considerably more alarming than I had thought, and that scientists and the media weren't doing a very good job of covering it. I guess I don't mind being called an alarmist, because Paul Revere was alarmist, and it's better than being the people who go around removing the batteries from smoke detectors. I think that, people who read the blog certainly know that I think, climate change is easily the biggest story of our time, and in 20 or 30 years it'll pretty much be the only story, as the world is sort of desperately coming together to stop try to feed 9 billion people on a planet where we have less fresh water, less arable land, 2 billion more people, I think that it will become probably, if we don't act in the next decade or so, it'll become the central organizing principle for humanity for decades and possibly for centuries. I think the coverage, I think there's a lot of flaws in the coverage. I think some journalists are better at not having the false balance between the deniers and the scientists. But, just in the last year, major false balance stories on PBS, BBC, New York Times, just world-class outlets still do it. I know being raised in a newspaper family, there's still this basic feeling that where there's smoke, there's fire. This is the best funded disinformation campaign in history. And they are able to generate a lot of smoke and blow it into people's faces. As Peter said, we've lost a lot of the best science and environment reporters. We're getting this story covered by people for whom this beat is very new. The Washington Post switched Juliet Alperin to the political White House beat and put their sports guy on the climate beat. In that world, people don't understand. So that's sort of, I still think the false balance is there. My bigger concern is other problems, the lack of coverage, which has dropped 80 to 90% from the high point in 2006 and 2007. The coverage of the wrong stories, which is a different type of false balance, something like 90, 95% of studies that come out are sort of more alarming than the basic view. But every so often there's a study that come out that isn't more alarming, and that study gets glommed onto. We saw that, before the over the summer with these stories of a low climate sensitivity and the supposed pause in climate change, I think that it isn't so much. It is true that climate scientists were put on the defensive, but they're really put on the defensive by the media. Scientists aren't great communicators, but they don't go to school to learn how to communicate. It's just not their job. And as someone who knows a lot of scientists and went to school with scientists, in fact, if scientists were good at communicating with people, they would have gotten into a different profession. So journalists are supposed to do that. Journalists are supposed to mediate between the scientific community and the public. And so, sign of community to be put on the defensive by the deniers requires the media to buy into their storyline. And I think that, you know, we did see that happening. I do think that I think if I hit this button, we'll come back. I do think that, you know, there's a quote that John Meacham, the Newsweek editor, said back in 2008, which I think is true. He said, "I absolutely believe the media is not ideologically driven, but conflict driven. We are engaged in the storytelling business, and if you tell the same story again and again, it's kind of boring." And I don't think there's any question that the flaws in reporting, as I see it, is not mostly from reporters, but from editors who are supposed to see the bigger picture. They're supposed to be able to connect the dots. They're supposed to be able to understand that this is the story of the century. And, you know, my father, who was an editor, had this quote about how newspaper editors were people who came down from the mountaintop at the end of the battle and shoot the wounded. I think that our biggest challenge is with the editors, not the reporters. All the reporters I met would love to be unleashed on this story. And for me, I ended up, you know, starting a blog through my frustration with the traditional media. And I spent a lot of time trying to communicate about how to communicate. And I spent a lot of time criticizing the media also. And I ended up writing this book, Language Intelligence, Lessons on Persuasion from Jesus, Shakespeare, Lincoln, and Lady Gaga, which talks about the art of being persuasive, the art of storytelling. The other thing that I have been doing for the past 3 years is working with some of the best storytellers in the country to launch a TV series, which Showtime is going to start airing in April. And this is executive produced by James Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jerry Weintraub, and the executive producers who are, you know, doing the day-to-day work are three former 60 Minutes producers who have 18 Emmys between them. So they really know how to tell stories. And so we've gotten a lot of high-profile reporters like Chris Hayes and Tom Friedman involved, but also some high-profile celebrities, and going to do, I think, 8 hours. So, you know, eight one-hour shows over a period of 2 months. And, you know, the good thing about Showtime is that they're quite open to being, you know, risky and cutting edge. They have a lot of programming, you know, where a hero is a serial killer or is a exceedingly neurotic home CIA agent. So they like this sort of thing. I have the sizzle reel, that I'm going to show here. If someone can kill the lights there. Hopefully this will work.
Scientists out of 100 say climate change is real and it's only going to get worse. So if you were sick and you got 100 doctors and 99 of them said you had to have an operation, would you get another opinion? I don't think so.
Our world is changing faster and more dramatically than ever before.
Global warming ended in 1998. I'll show you the data for it.
There's so many political agendas, there's been so many exaggerations that it's brought a lot of confusion.
Ice melt, rising sea levels.
There is no more fire season. We have wildfires all year round.
What do you think Republicans have gotten in this spot, distrusting the scientists?
Methane coming out pipes all over the country. That's a big deal.
At what point does this become the priority?
Fire for methane.
Everybody thinks that this is about melting glaciers and polar bears. I think it's a big mistake.
So at
teamed up with the legendary Jerry Weintraub.
So the hurricanes are twice as big as they ever were. Ice is melting, but it's not supposed to melt.
This is a lake?
Yes. The world is changing, and it's all because of global warming, I think.
Jerry and I are putting together the ultimate cast. You'll see these stars like you've never seen them before. They're going to be the correspondents. Meeting the people affected by this. These are the stories of people whose lives have been transformed by climate change.
We used to have seasons back then. Now we don't.
Could Yemen run out of water?
And I think that as a result, the drama that editors think in terms of is this drama of scientists versus deniers. But the real drama is that we're all living in this, you know, climate-changed world, and the stories of the extreme weather events that are starting to hit and be supercharged by climate change is going to just become the norm. And, you know, I'll just end with one statistic. The everyone, you know, can remember visualizing the pictures of the Hurricane Sandy storm surge on Atlantic City. There was a study that just came out that you know, if we keep doing, if we don't reverse carbon pollution trends pretty quickly, then, you know, in 50 years, that kind of storm surge will be occurring every year. So, you know, these stories of people, drought, wildfire, superstorms, you know, these are going to be the stories of the century. And hopefully more and more people, more and more editors, you know, will see that this is a story worth covering.
Thank you. Let me ask you one question. As there are two things that we either like to do as journalists or we have to do sometimes because of the shrinking size of the stories that we can produce or write or what our editors are demanding. And one of those is to make the story simple. Which means to take out the nuance as much as possible, and I'm curious how you what you say about that. I was looking at this. This looks great. It's amazing, and it's amazing that it's going to be on the air. On the other hand, in order to really write a scientifically accurate story about disasters and climate change, it's got to have a fair amount of nuance. You can't attribute, you know, the whole attribution problem. Was Katrina, was Sandy caused by global warming or any other storm or any other heat wave? That's a complicated issue that requires some explaining to make it correct. And I'm curious what you have to say about that. And something related, which is, does a story have to have a good side or a happy ending? Because that's another thing that we want to do, and we're also called on to do, is something good, the good news. There is good news. There are interesting things that new technologies. There's all sorts of things, but fundamentally, it's a very bad news story. And how do you handle that? Treating our audience as adults that we're actually in very sad in very bad shape.
Sure. Well, that's I think I counted three questions. I'll try to answer them in
two out of three would be good
in reverse order. I think I'll certainly say, for someone who's been blogging, you know, for 7 years and written maybe 3 or 4 million words on the subject, that we've been pretty blunt about what's going to happen if we don't take action. And, you know, I worked at the Department of Energy for 5 years, so I have no difficulty explaining that we have more than enough technology to start slashing emissions sharply. You know, there is a good news story, but I do think, you know, it's ironic that there certainly is the case that many in the media say, you know, this is too gloomy a story, when, in fact, all they ever run is gloomy stories. I mean, you know, there's a reason why the saying is, if it bleeds, it leads. That's, you know, if you watch the news, you'd get the impression that, you know, children are being kidnapped all the time, and that, you know, women are being assaulted all the time, and that you know, there's, you know, crazy, there's a lot of crazy things going on all the time, but there's, you know, 300 million people in this country, so it's not very hard to find these stories. So I think that, you know, from my perspective, people need to be informed, not just because hopefully they will wake up and realize, geez, I should get politically active and we can solve this problem. They need to be informed because this is going to affect their lives and their children's lives. And do they want to own coastal property? Do they want to retire to South Florida? Do they want to retire to Phoenix, Arizona? You know, and what should their children study in school? What is the world going to be like? I mean, they're just huge, huge questions. So I think that people just need to be informed. And if there's bad, you know, if there's a gloomy side to things, then I think people just have to own up to it, that it's in our control to avoid all that, but we've chosen not to do it. You know, the scientifically accurate story, I think, is certainly very important, and I am chief science editor for this. So I'm not a, you know, the storytelling guy. I'm mostly the guy to keep stuff off the air if it isn't right. You know, I think this gets back to what Peter said about the preponderance of evidence. I think that, from my point of view, we have reached a tipping point on extreme weather, so that now there are a great many climate scientists who are willing, who see that we've just had all this off-the-charts extreme weather for the last 2 to 3 years, and stuff that a lot of meteorologists have never seen and never expected to see this soon. And so there's a lot more literature emerging about how global warming makes droughts more likely, makes them more intense, makes them longer. Same for heat waves and wildfires, same for superstorms. And there's also an emerging, you know, science that some of this is connected to larger changes in atmospheric patterns driven by the loss of Arctic ice. I actually think that, you know, in 10 or 20 years we'll look back on the last few years as the inflection point. So this is a real-time story, and I think it's just incumbent on anyone telling a story to be upfront that there are scientists who, you know, understand, you know, think they understand what's going on and try to explain it. I don't think that one should be, you know, a newspaper article is not held to the same standard as an IPCC report, and I don't think it should be. And I think it's a mistake to think that one has to be able to prove something 100% because we report on a lot of stuff that we can't prove 100% all the time. I think, like I said, though, you're now the important thing, and I've always said this on the blog, that if the single most important sign for me that someone has done a good job of reporting on climate change is how many climate scientists they've talked to. And, you know, one of the things that we'll do on the series, since there's the TV segments will have science in them, but it's not going to be loaded up with science, is to do a lot of this on the web. So on the web, you can have, you know, extended video interviews with scientists who can get into more depth than you can get on TV. And I think that's one way to get at this. You know, this gets, and this, you would ask this, you know, about making the story simple. Certainly one of the points that I make in my book Language Intelligence is that from the point of view of being persuasive and memorable, there is a whole the greatest communicators throughout history all use the same trick. They're not really taught anymore, but they used to be taught a lot. They're called the figures of speech. And one way to make a story simpler is to use metaphors, and those are the simplest way of simplifying something in a way that can convey a lot of information in a relatively short period of time. And it's something scientists have historically been taught not to do. They've been taught to be literal-minded, not figurative. But I think that we're starting to see scientists use more metaphors, like, you know, the climate system on carbon pollution is like a baseball player on steroids. And I think that the most important thing is to convey information in a clear fashion that is backed up by, you know, credible climate scientists saying it. And I think that, as I said, I think there are a lot of tricks to keeping a story from being, you know, overly long and sprawling, but still communicate that information. And we'll see, you know, with the TV series whether or not we succeed.
Great. Catherine?
Hi.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
Sorry.
You'll need that.
Yeah. So, like Dan said, I am the newbie on the panel. I first started reporting on climate change in about 2008, and it was I was getting a master's degree at Columbia in Earth and Environmental Sciences. That was my first master's, and I was seeing my mentors and my professors, all the scientists at the Lamont-Doherty Earth Observatory. It was after the 2007 IPCC report. Skeptic misinformation campaigns were really starting to ramp up, and they were frustrated that their work, their research, was being twisted and that they didn't know how to communicate what they wanted, and they didn't know how to talk to journalists. And so that's when I really started getting into covering climate change. And then I moved to the journalism school at Columbia and did a science focus. But, you know, one of the things that I think is interesting is, you know, that question of have we failed in our coverage of climate change. I think it's nuanced because I think traditional mainstream media has failed, but I think that in the past few years we've seen an incredible number of climate and environment-focused news sites pop up. I think it's telling that the three of us up here are at such sites, and so I think that sites like that are helping to fill the void that's been caused. And one of the problems, one of the reasons that these kind of traditional mainstream media places have not been able to, I think, do the proper coverage of climate change is, like has been mentioned, they've been slashing staffs, and oftentimes environmental reporters and science reporters are the first to go, which I think is interesting because, for me, it would be like cutting tech reporters in the middle of the dot-com bubble. You know, we are ramping up climate change. We are just seeing the effects more and more, and yet we have less and less experience in the newsrooms to be able to cover this, that have, you know, the history, that know the history of this debate and actually know the science of the debate. And so I think you can't just one of the problems is I think editors think, okay, well, the IPCC report is coming out. This person has a little bit of science background. I'm just going to throw them on there. And that's where you get reporters that are very confused, and they don't know who the experts are, and they don't know who to trust. And so if they just do a general search, they might look at, you know, Mark Morano and see, well, he's a very public figure on climate change. I'm going to talk to him. He seems like everybody else does. And I think one of the other problems is that a lot of times in the news we have been focused on covering the basics of climate change, defending whether or not it's happening. And that's something that scientists have been having to do for years. I mean, that's basically what the IPCC report has been doing. It has just been defending the basic principles, the basic science behind climate change for years. And so part of the problem is that I think a lot of the news coverage is stuck on the surface, and we're past that point. Americans are starting to see the effects of climate change literally in their backyards when their homes are being carried away in floods and when their homes and businesses go up in flames or are being flooded by Superstorm Sandy. And polls have shown that these extreme weather events are drastically changing Americans' views of climate change, and yet the media is still one of the areas that I think is the biggest missed opportunities is connecting these weather events to climate change. You know, these are real teachable moments. These are moments in which Americans are captivated in that, you know, whether or not it's a short period of time, because as you guys know, I mean, many Americans have very short attention spans when it comes to these things. But by not having the media cover the connection, I think it's a missed opportunity. And so at most places fear, they don't want to do this because they don't want to politicize a tragedy. That's often what I hear a lot of editors saying. But you can compare it to if the shooting in Newtown, you know, you cover the tragedy, but then you also move into a discussion of gun legislation. Why isn't it the same for climate change? And if you want to even go at a more local level, a bridge collapses. Okay, you cover, you know, exactly why the bridge collapses, but you also trace back what might have happened to cause this bridge to collapse. What were the contributing factors? And a salmonella outbreak, same thing. I mean, this is what we do in the news, is we cover, you know, an event, but then we dig deeper, and that's one of the things that hasn't been happening. And so I think you can look at the wildfire in Arizona, in Yarnell, as a perfect example of this, where you had local papers in Arizona not cover the climate change angle at all. And there were national papers that did do this. But it's when you're dealing with the people that are actually the most powerful thing that you can do is to reach the people that are actually being affected by these events. And so by the Arizona papers not covering this, I think people are misunderstanding why wildfires are happening so often, or why the Colorado droughts or Colorado flooding happened. And I think there's different. What you have to be careful about, there are several things that journalists have to be careful about when covering these extreme events. Local papers, from everybody that I talk to, can take a little bit of distance. Cover the tragedy first. That's the most important thing. You're dealing with grieving families, grieving communities. So, but it's irresponsible to not cover it eventually. But national publications don't have as much of that responsibility. They can and should dive into the larger conversation much sooner. And I talked to a tragedy expert after the Yarnell fires who actually said, you know, that you don't have to be as concerned about offending people or politicizing a tragedy, that the people are looking for answers after something like this, and so that journalists shouldn't be afraid of making these connections. But, I mean, like Dan and Joe were talking about, you need to be careful with the language. You know, did climate change cause the wildfire in Yarnell? No. Ultimately, it was a lightning strike that caused the wildfire. But did it contribute to the severity and the size of the wildfire? Definitely. And yet very few local papers acknowledged that. So I think, you know, it's something to take into consideration. There's also, you also have to consider what scientists know about different weather events. You can't treat wildfires the same as you can tornadoes, for example, because the science is less clear between the connection between climate science, climate change, and tornadoes. So there's a lot of things to be really careful about with this coverage, but I think that it's really important for journalists to do it. And so hopefully, we're just going to be seeing more and more of these events, and so hopefully more places are able to do it. And part of the problem is if you don't have the staff at these papers, especially at local papers, then they don't have somebody in the newsroom saying, we need to make this connection. There's no editor, there's no journalist saying, this is something that we need to talk about. And that's something that I think is really missing. So, yeah.
Thank you. Well, let me just ask you one question, and then we'll open it up. I guess you might say the good news is there are more and more extreme events, and that gives more journalists more opportunities to report, to perhaps make these connections. One problem that the media's had in the past is how do you report on a story that to some extent it doesn't change? It's the same story. We're as a society and in a planet we're screwing up and we're going to be in big trouble. And then there are little additions to that along the way. And so I wonder if you have any thoughts on that issue, that there's the story. How do you keep on reporting the same story, essentially?
So I think one of the things is one of the ways is you localize the story, and that's one of the benefits of covering these extreme weather events. Is you know it's easy to. It's easy for somebody in Arizona or in the Midwest to disregard talk about rising sea levels. For them, what difference does it make? But if you localize the story and talk about, you know, what are the specific impacts? What exactly are they going to feel? What effects are they going to be dealing with? I think that's one of the most powerful ways that we can talk about the story in new ways to engage people. In this kind of broader stories, unless you talk to them about exactly why this is important for them, of course they're not going to care. Especially when you have Americans who a lot of Americans are inherently distrustful of science, and so for a lot of them, they don't want to know. They don't actively go out and research climate change because they don't see how it's going to affect them. They don't trust the science, and so if you bring it to them and kind of force it into their backyards and say, this is going to affect you, I think that's one of the most powerful ways you can do it.
Well, why don't we open it up to the audience now. Now, the rule, as everybody knows, is that the journalists get to ask their questions first. And please identify yourself. And I'm going to repeat your question so that it can be recorded. Tom?
Yeah, so I just wanted to pick up on that. My name is Tom Yulesman, Center for Environmental Journalism. I wanted to pick up on what you were talking about, localizing extreme events. I'm from Boulder. Just a really humiliating extreme event. Never experienced anything like that. And so here's a perfect opportunity to do that. Yes?
Yeah.
Maybe not. We don't know yet what the role of climate change was in that extreme weather event that we experienced. We had the precipitable water in the atmosphere was 200% greater than normal, mm-hmm. So that's huge. Globally, we've added about 5% water vapor to the atmosphere, so the atmosphere is warmer. So I look at that and try to do the nuance, and I say, I don't really know what kind of connection I can make at this point to that event. There may well be one, but we may not know for 2 months exactly what we can say. So the question that I have is, this is really tricky ground. Some extreme weather events are connected, others are not. It's really difficult to make that connection. How do we do what you say we should do?
Let me just repeat that quickly, and also, and then I'll pass it to Catherine, and then maybe the others want to say something about this. The question is, in this extreme event like the floods in Colorado, at what point do you feel like you know enough so that you can actually make a connection between a meteorological event and a change in the climate?
So I think one of the most important things is just to call scientists. I think a lot of reporters are hesitant to do that unless they have a story that they know exactly what they want to say. There's nothing wrong with just calling a scientist and saying, what is the connection, in your opinion? Talk to me. Is there a connection? Do you guys know? So I think that's the first step, is opening up those pathways of communication. And I think you can also, it is tricky, but it's my understanding with the Colorado floods that, for example, because there had been droughts in the area, you have soil that is drier, and so the water can't penetrate, which means it's going to run off faster. You also have wildfires that strip the land of surface vegetation that can hold back the water. Those are all factors. So it is tricky, and I don't think there's an all-encompassing answer, but I would just say that, you know, talking to scientists, especially in Colorado, there are so many scientists that you could talk to about this. So just getting their opinions.
Do either of you two want to?
I did, and everyone is telling me to be really, really careful here.
Yeah.
And, you know, more so than I was initially inclined to do.
And I think scientists are... I also think that the past few years have made a lot of scientists very hesitant to make sweeping statements when they aren't sure, because they've been, I guess, to kind of, I don't know, use a teenage phrase, burned in the past. But I guess, I don't know if there's an easy answer to this. I don't know. Do you either of you guys have?
Well, I think... You know, there are certainly some scientists that I talk to a lot on this, like Kevin Trenberth at the National Center for Atmospheric Research out there. I think there's a few things to be said. Clearly, for an extreme deluge, as you said, we have more water vapor in the atmosphere, and that is going to create more extreme deluges of this kind. And... as Kat said, we're in this particular case, you had the wildfires and droughts, and that certainly contributed. I think that the big unknown question is whether there are shifts in the atmospheric circulation pattern, so-called blocking patterns, big high level pressure systems that are causing storms to stall, because storms have always happened. The question is, you know, if a intense rain event gets stuck for 3 days, what can we say? And I think this is one of those areas of emerging science, and I think you can certainly find some people, you know, who have like Stu Ostro at the Weather Channel, who is, I'm sure you've seen his 900-page PDF. You know, he'd be the first person to tell you that it's not something you can, like, prove, but boy, have there been a whole lot of blocking patterns that have happened in the last few years that he doesn't, you know, ever recall seeing before. For me, of course, the point, since we couldn't, whatever disaster hit, it's too late to stop that. The issue is, it's clear these thousand-year rainstorms are just going to become, you know, 100-year events, and the 100-year events are going to become 10-year events. I think people need to understand that. Tennessee got swamped with a thousand-year rainstorm. It didn't get the same attention, back in 2010 that the Boulder event has gotten. But, you know, I think that being able to tell the parts of the story that one can tell with confidence, you know, with confidence, and the parts that are emerging, one tells more cautiously. But I do think it's important for people to know this is what we expect to see a lot more of in the future. And you know, whoever it was, I think it may have been Overpeck, who had said, you know, of the drought, this is what climate change looks like. I think it's important for people to understand that, because, as I'm sure you know, Tom, a large fraction of the public and opinion makers seem to think that climate change is going to affect people far away a long time from now. And, you know, that is just not the case.
Do you want to say something?
Yeah. It's a question of trends. And I used the analogy before about beyond a reasonable doubt versus preponderance of evidence. And Tom, you're right. There wouldn't even be a preponderance of evidence here, but there is sufficient evidence to ask the question, and that is absolutely the role of journalists. I would differ with a portion of what Kat said in terms of the local media covering this. the local media, I agree, would be absolutely derelict in their duty to not raise the climate change question. But as an editor and kind of a gatekeeper, if I were running a local paper, the first concern is the immediate local impact. And that is a second or third or even a fourth day story. If you're talking about the Yarnell fire or the Boulder floods, you need to bury the dead. You need to say where the funerals are. You need to talk about evacuation and locations and what school gyms people are going to be sleeping in. And that first is, I would think, the primary role of a local paper, which is probably why you see the national papers or national news organizations jumping on the climate story first. It's absolutely essential that local papers try to develop or acquire the expertise and the institutional knowledge to ask those questions about climate. But I'm actually comfortable if that comes a few days after you bury the dead and get the main story out of the way and tell people that they're out of danger from the fire or the flood.
Yeah,
by the way, there were a lot of questions about the fracking story and the damage in Colorado from leaks from oil and gas operations. That is absolutely an imperative story, but I would make that a second or third day story as well.
Okay, right back there. No, right.
Peter kind of touched upon, my name is Linda Morris, and I'm a contributing editor at Discover, and I just got done writing a book about climate change. Peter touched upon this a little bit, but I sort of feel like we're not talking about the elephant in the room, which is the fact that there are tremendous corporate interests that are deeply invested in maintaining the status quo. And the other piece of this is the tremendous corporatization of the media that we've seen in the past decade. Just sort of parenthetically, I was at the LA Times in 2000 when the Tribune bought it, and the atmosphere in the newsroom changed almost overnight, and the kind of pressures our editors were under to really scale back in their investigative coverage and stories was really enormous. And, you know, I sort of feel that that's part of the reason why we're seeing these extreme weather events. I mean, look at Bloomberg, the way he covered Sandy in Bloomberg News, because he owns it, and he can cover it the way he wants to. And that's part of why they're not making the connection. And maybe you guys could comment on this.
I'll take a first stab at that.
Okay, we have a question on two things. One is the climate corporate paid climate denialism, and also the fact that who owns newspapers?
I think you're right about the elephant in the room, and if we haven't covered it yet, I would say only in our defense that we are in a room of 1,000 elephants, and that is one of them. Here's something that again falls into that category of I could never prove it. I was never directly interfered with on behalf of a sponsor at CNN about a climate story. One of the reasons for that is that we rarely get to do climate stories. The other one is that if that stuff goes on, it would not go on at my level where I would be able to come out and write a book and issue a press release about it as they threw me in the parking lot. But there's a guy named Bob Brule who is a social sciences PhD at Drexel University who has followed the amount of oil, gas, and coal advertising in television news. And over the past few years, his ballpark estimates are that it is in the billions of dollars. And again, just like the floods in Boulder and the length, you've got to ask the questions. I don't have a smoking gun. I can't prove that there is a causal link from that cash flow to reluctance to cover an issue. But we damn well ought to be asking the questions, because you cannot swing a dead cat in the middle of a 22-minute network newscast and not run into that lady telling you how the oil industry is generating jobs and how their pipelines are perfectly safe. Pipelines are perfectly safe, right?
Oh, yeah.
And that happens. Often you can't draw that direct provable line from a congressman or a senator voting a certain way when they get $1 million from the oil industry like Jim Inhofe does. And the throwaway line is that money doesn't influence my vote. Can you prove that that's false? No. But what do you think? And I think the same way about the broadcasters. The elections broadcasts in 2008 and 2012 were virtually bought and paid for by the clean coal industry. Does that not turn the heads of my old bosses? I can't prove that it does, but if you want me to guess, you want me to bet, you want me to speculate, It has to.
Yes, in the toward the front there, yeah.
Don Corrigan, Webster Kirkwood Science in St. Louis. When I write columns and stories, I still use the term global warming, and I get lectured about how it's not climate change by some folks. So I sort of look at that as already admission and backtracking from the critics that we have to say climate change instead of global warming. And I think with readers of the audience, they sort of say, oh, look, they're already sort of, the journalists are already changing on this thing. They're already sort of, and we're making progress back, you know. So I'm wondering how you react to that.
The question is the term global warming or climate change. What's the thinking on which is most appropriate?
I was at a... you'll be interested to know, I was at an event where I was the only scientist and, you know, person concerned about climate change, and everyone else was, I'd say, in the conservative intelligentsia. And their version of the question is, aren't you liberals using this term climate change because the planet's not warming? That sort of nonsense. Now, what's funny about this is, of course, it's called the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was founded like 25 years ago. The scientific community uses both of the terms almost interchangeably. I've, used both the terms interchangeably. It is famously Frank Luntz, who it was one of the Republican wordmeisters, wrote a famous memo, which you can find online, back in 2002, in which he actually urged conservatives to use climate change rather than global warming, just because he, in his polling, found that it was less threatening. So conservatives stopped using the term global warming. They use climate change. And I think climate change is used a bit more than global warming. There are a lot of studies as to whether it makes any bit of difference on how people react to it. And the answer is, the studies don't necessarily tell you the same thing. I use them both interchangeably. Niña to La Niña. Come 30 or 40 years ago, 30 or 40 years from now, all that stuff is going to be by the wayside. An interesting analogy is cigarette smoking. I mean, there was a good AP story, I think it was by Seth, that in which he said, the certainty level on global warming is now about where it is on cigarette smoking. Now, if you smoke two packs a day, I can't tell you that you're going to get cancer. And not only that, if you get cancer, I can't tell you 100% certainly that the cigarette smoking caused cancer. But no one reports that anymore, because we've moved past the disinformation campaign to a world where everyone understands that, if you smoke two packs a day, you are dramatically increasing your risk of cancer. And if you did, and if someone dies of lung cancer and they smoked, no one says, well, geez, maybe the two weren't related. So, we're kind of where we were in cigarette smoking 20 years ago with climate change, we're at a point where the warming is just what I would say the signal is just breaking through the noise, and so we're starting to see weather events, thousand-year weather events, things that are really off the charts. Come 10 years from now, it'll be considerably different. Now, the job for people who are trying to communicate the threat is that climate change is incredibly slow moving. So, unlike a lot of other threats, if one waits until everybody is willing to say, geez, this is like the world's worst problem, and it's obvious to everybody, then it's too late. So the challenge is in the public policy realm, we make lots of investments in things based on our best judgment. And, the great, great tragedy of climate change is that it's, when you think about it, it's crazy that the nations of the world and the United States in particular feels it has to wait until, like, every last person is so informed that it's obvious to them. The point of the government is to find experts to identify problems and listen to them and then act accordingly, because obviously the average member of the public can't be an expert on what the best way to deal with wildfires is, or what the best way to deal with floods is, or even the best way to deal with an epidemic. So it's the whole point of government is we elect representatives. They find who are the most informed people. Those informed people tell us, like a diagnosis, this is what you ought to do. And it is, you know, immoral, and there's a talk, you know, tomorrow on that, but it is beyond immoral that we reject the experts of the world telling us we ought to act because there's some fraction of people who aren't yet convinced. I mean, that is clearly the path to ruin.
Do you guys want to weigh in on this?
Yeah.
I was just going to say that in terms of the, going back to the terms, using the terms, we at Inside Climate use both interchangeably, but we have noticed that in the past few months the term global warming has kind of come under attack because of the skeptic attention given to the climate pause. And so occasionally kind of looking at that, we'll kind of scale it back just a little bit, but we'd use both.
I think, Tom, that's reasonable, but I also think I am not going to get my trousers in a wad about whether we call it global warming or climate change. Let me throw one more thing on it. John Holdren, the science advisor a few years ago, suggested, and it was met with crickets and silence, that we change it again to climate disruption. That's when we get into silly season. That's when global warming to climate change to climate disruption is changing your name like your P. Diddy. And it doesn't help anybody's understanding. Or Prince, or here's the best example. This is just marketing and general communication wisdom that has nothing specific to do with climate science or politics or anything. The Environmental Defense Fund changed its name based on focus groups to Environmental Defense. And all of a sudden, their acronym, ED, was showing up everywhere because Viagra had just hit the market. And so here's your nice environmental defense, your ED board, which is mostly 60-year-old white guys, saying, how did we get this name? And, of course, they changed it back.
Okay, so let's move on. The lesson here is don't get your pants in a wad. Adam?
I hate to follow that in an ED joke. Adam Glenn, I teach journalism at CUNY, a journalism school. I edit the SE Journal, and also recently launched a site on climate adaptation in New York City, and I want to ask about adaptation. This latest journal, which if you haven't seen it, has a cover package on Is Adaptation the Next Climate Beat? One of the interesting pieces in here from a fellow at Penn State talks about the degree to which the adaptation message actually helps solidify the fact that climate change is real because you've moved on to some form of action. But it's adaptation obviously is a fraught issue because of the attention drawn from mitigation. So I just want to get a sense from you of where adaptation fits into this discussion, positive, negative, neutral.
So this is, the question is on the how to balance between adaptation and mitigation in climate coverage.
So I think that's actually, I have a note here in my notes, that that's where I would like to see a lot of the coverage start shifting to. I think people are, the more and more that people are getting hit by climate change, I think that there's kind of a feeling of helplessness. And I think, like anybody, you need to start giving people a sense of what we can do to protect themselves, to fight climate change. I think, you know, just the CNN Morning Show, for example, has their daily good news story, which makes me cringe often what the story is, but I think it's a good, I think it's something that people should consider, because I think there's a point at which you start losing people's attention when you just bring up the negative and everything that's going to happen, and these are the disasters, and oh my gosh, we're all doomed. But when you start giving people solutions and ways that they can actually get involved in this and protect themselves, I think it changes the conversation. And like you said, it moves beyond is climate change happening to this is happening and this is what we can do about it. And I think also there's lots of opportunities in that beat for local reporting and national reporting. So there's plenty of stories to go around.
Yeah. There's a lot I would say about adaptation. It's not a term I particularly like because I think it's misleading. John Holdren again, often says the future is going to be some combination of mitigation, adaptation, and misery. And the less you do of the mitigation, the more you're going to have to do adaptation, and the more misery there's going to be. As you may know, relevant to the climate change versus global warming discussion, adaptation is fading out and resilience is in. And resilience actually is not even a word I like anymore. If you read the blog, I think what's going to really happen is some combination of abandonment and triage, and then misery. I think historically we adapt to changing climate by abandonment. The word desert means abandoned place. You've deserted it, if you don't desert a place, you have to spend a staggering amount of money. And I think people haven't – one of the reasons why people are talking about adaptation, and I don't have any trouble talking with adaptation because obviously we're not going to mitigate. We're going to have to deal with the fact that we have eventually 9 billion people living in a place that – places determined by a climate that was no longer stable. And so it doesn't rain the way they thought. It doesn't have the sea level they thought it. I think that one of the reasons people are talking adaptation is because they've been bombarded by the disinformation campaign that mitigation is incredibly expensive and onerous. If you think mitigation is expensive and onerous, just try stopping the Hurricane Sandy storm surge. I mean, and this is important to understand, if you put a seawall around New York, because New York is rich, when the hurricane comes up and slams the water against the coast, the water goes somewhere. And the answer is it goes where you couldn't afford to put the seawall. And we saw that with the hurricane that hit New Orleans. You can protect some parishes, but you can't protect them all, and that's where you get to triage. What are you going to save and what are you not going to save? These are choices that you have to really understand and accept climate science before you can make those decisions. So we're not, I'm sure there are places in Virginia, North Carolina, where sea level rise is viewed as a political term. And I think it's going to be as big a political battle, because adaptation, as I say, triage and abandonment is really about the government and experts telling you where you can and can't live. You can't live in a 100-year floodplain because it's not a 100-year floodplain anymore. We're not going to allow the insurance of coastal property. You can't buy insurance for storm damage on the coast of Florida, except that Florida passed a law that means the state is the insurer. Except the only reason the state agreed to be the insurer is they know that if another Andrew hits, then everyone in this room will bail out the state of Florida because states don't go bankrupt. But that, isn't going to happen more than once. So, we're just in a world where people can talk about adaptation and resilience because they haven't really internalized what climate change means. And when they really internalized climate change, if they really understood climate change, they would put all their money, you know, 90% of their money on avoiding the worst stuff rather than figuring out how to adapt to it.
Just one sentence to add to that. I've seen mistakes made in coverage in both the TV and in some print stories of defining and framing adaptation as surrender. There's nothing we can do about this, so here's what we have to do to cope with it. And that is a cardinal mistake for journalists to make.
Unfortunately, lunch is just about to start. We're actually already over by 10 minutes. I was told we should go up to 10 minutes after the scheduled time. So we got to go, and you'll just have to catch the panelists here some other point and ask them your questions. This is a great session. I'm glad everybody came.